Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything that we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Chapter 42 of Henry Ford's The International Jew, written 100 years ago or so, back in 1920, 1921. And this rounds out the second volume. There's 80 chapters, four volumes. This is the last chapter of Volume 2. I don't know that the volume of these makes any particular difference. It's not like they're overly grouped. They somewhat skip around. We just got done with a couple on Poland, and now we're turning to the chapter 42, which is titled The Present Status of the Jewish Question. Well, let's dig right on in. The Jewish question in the United States has existed for years, but until now in silence and suspicion. Everyone knew that there was such a question. The Jew himself knew best of all, but very few possessed the courage to open the question to the sanitary influences of sunlight and speech. The mention of courage in this connection is needful to help explain the silence. So people are thinking about it, and they know it's there, but they're not talking about it. A few men of insight have actually attempted publicly to define the question in the United States, and they have been so effectually dealt with by an invisible power of which the public could have no knowledge that free speech on the Jewish question naturally became unpopular. The fact, it is true, reflects far more seriously on non-Jews than on Jews, but it is a fact nevertheless. He who undertakes to speak the truth on this question must expect far more opposition than he could ever withstand were he not speaking the truth. So the only thing that allows him to withstand the opposition is that he's speaking the truth. It matters him very much, and it won't go away. It continues to be what holds together the regime of lies and anti-whiteism, is that Jews and their agenda are what are causing all of these problems we observe, some of which we're allowed to talk about, provided we don't go to their true cause. And that constitutes political discourse, either people promoting the things that are killing us or people opposing them in a way that doesn't identify their cause and origins. And if you wish to go beyond that because you perceive what's actually going on and blame the Jews for what they're doing, for their actual agenda, then you will encounter the real resistance. And like Hitler's men said, if you're not getting blasted by the Jews in the press daily, you're not doing your job. The Jews have come up with their ultimate ideological concoctions, terminology, racism and anti-Semitism, to drive whites away precisely from what they need. Racism, a love and loyalty of their own, that's racism. And realizing that Jews are the source of the problems that are threatening their race to the level of genocide, why, that's anti-Semitism. So they use their most powerful words to make taboo to do and perceive and believe and act in ways that are most necessary to preserve your own kind. They made it a taboo to like and defend your own kind using terms they've come up with, or someone's come up with that they've recognized the value of, as supposedly Wilhelm Marr, a non-Jew journalist, came up with anti-Semitism, but they recognize they can use that. It's a little trick we use that we always play, as one of them said famously on a video on YouTube. It's a conceptual trick like racism. And, you know, even as I'm writing this, to give you a contemporary example from 1950, when I'm talking, you could be listening to me in 1,000 years and it would still be true, because Jews have behaved in the ways that we're talking about for thousands of years. We're simply studying the manifestation of Jewish behavior in one particular time. That would be in the U.S. and in Europe. During the time generally right around the First World War and its aftermath is when Henry Ford was writing about it. But 100 years later, when I was talking to you about Jews and the problems they cause, for example, a court in France had just declared that there are no native white French, therefore providing a legal and pseudo-historical basis for opening France to the Third World and the Muslims who are destroying white society there, which was the thing that everyone was talking about in 2015. As an example, in Germany, they just brought in over 1 million Syrian Muslim immigrants, many of whom were Afghanis or Somalis or Pakistanis. This is what's going on in Europe at the time. The ultimate solution to the white problem is for white people not to exist, for the white race not to exist, and the Jews would lie that the white race doesn't exist. But what we're talking about here today with Henry Ford is 100 years ago when they were not in position to bring about all these things because they hadn't yet macerated the public in decades of propaganda, even though they did control the media. There was not enough nationalized electronic media. There was not enough strong enough public schooling to thoroughly dip. They had not bought enough politicians to completely drown and drench ordinary whites in these lies that they need to get implanted in people's heads. So they weren't in the as powerful a position then as they are now, but let's see about what they were doing. In this chapter, the present status of the Jewish question. So, he who undertakes to speak the truth in this question must expect far more opposition than he could ever withstand were he not speaking the truth. The problem is it doesn't go away because it is true. And they get agitated and attack you because it's true. If it were false, well, they're the ones who own the loudspeakers. They would simply point out the facts to the audience so the audience could see you were lying. But when it's true, all they can do is defame you and suppress your voice. And that's what they do. One fact that militated against free speech in the Jewish question was the condition into which our American people have been trained of expecting applause and approval to follow every act and word. There was a time in American history, and it was the most glorious period of our past, when opposition was considered an often desirable attitude. A man's weight was accounted equal, whether computed by the number of his enemies or his friends. But a softening has come over us. A softening change has come over us. We have grown to like applause. Hisses used to stir our fathers. Hisses cow their sons. Public speech has thus grown flabby. The press has thus become neutral. We have grown pudgy and futile in our program of, quote, helping the weak, unquote. So pudgy and futile that we no longer have gristle to attack the strong who have brought weakness upon others, upon the others. As a people, we have passed the bunk around, bunk in quotes. Big word back then. It was still a new jargon or slang back then. We have passed the bunk around so habitually. We have enervated our judgment and moral conviction so seriously by our fake philosophy of boost. We have become so accustomed to measure the effectiveness of work by the applause it immediately provokes that we have lost all stomach for courses that call for contest, unless it be those spurious contests of the political arena, which are all managed from the same great headquarters. Or those verbal assaults against big business which bring no reaction. We have lost all taste for tangible foes who have a ready retaliation. So the Jews can fight back because of their superior organization. He said last chapter that Jews were better organized than the United States government, or perhaps it was even this chapter. It may have been because I was reading it ahead and quoted a couple on Twitter. But he's saying 100 years ago, spurious contests of the political arena, which are all managed from the same great headquarters. So no matter who you vote for, you get the same agenda. We have lost all taste for tangible foes who have a ready retaliation. We're not in the fighting mood. We want everything we say to be approved. Nevertheless, says Ford, it is true that, whereas a year ago, it was not possible to speak the word Jew in the United States, this would be about 1919, it is now possible in 1920. The name appears on the front page of every newspaper nearly every day. It is the subject of discussion everywhere. For the time at least, speech has been liberated, although our friends of the B'nai B'rith in every state are doing their best to throttle it. This freedom is of benefit both to Jew and non-Jew. The Jew need no longer look askance at the name of his race on the lips of the non-Jew. It only means that suppression and deceit are past, that is all. The Jew is a Jew, is recognized as a Jew, is spoken of as a Jew, and thus an honest relation between the mind and the fact is established in both the Jew and the non-Jew. The air is cleared. Concealment on the one hand is done away. On the other hand, a missing fact, whose absence meant confusion, is supplied. So if you don't use the word Jew, you're confusing people by not giving them the clear, simple explanation that's called for. The Jew may now say, I am a Jew, as casually as any other man might claim his race. We may even see some noted Americans who all their lives have tried to conceal their race come forward now and say, we are Jews. It is freedom to the Jew. It is interpretation to the non-Jew. Half the confusion which men meet in their efforts to account for the world is due to their ignorance of just where the Jew is. He is always a key. But if the key be disguised as something else, how can it be used? About 8 months ago, the Dearborn Independent began a series of studies on the Jewish question. It was an attempt to state the facts on which the question is based. It was not at its beginning, nor has it since developed into, an attack on Jews as Jews. Its purpose was enlightenment, and if it secretly indulged a hope, it was this, that the leaders of American Jewry might be wise to see that this is the country and this is the time in which the causes of distress and distrust and disrepute might be removed from Jewry and a genuine modus operandi, not of toleration, but of reconciliation, arrived at. And I consider this extremely naive because it's looking at Jews from a white point of view. And the white point of view is if we clear up what the problem is, they will meet us halfway and acknowledge the problem and solve it. And this is silly because the Jew has been acting this way for all its recorded history, which suggests to you that it's not how they behave, it's what they are. As the late Edgar Steele used to say, and he actually got it from Donald Day, I believe, it's gone to seed. They can't change who they are. I mean, they might temporize for expediency or because it suits their interest, they might adapt their behavior, but they are never going to do it out of any respect for the wishes of Goyim, whom they have no respect for. And that's not just their entire record of proven behavior. It's in their so-called religious book, their Talmud. So you're really, in a way, I always emphasize this, you're showing them disrespect when you're thinking that they can change. They can't change. They adapt. They'll suppress it if they're being beaten down, but they're never going to do it out of what you're thinking, recognizing that they're wrong and changing their ways. They simply aren't going to do it. There is no record of Jews ever doing that anywhere. They may be down, they may be up, but they always think about non-Jews in the same way. That's their entire doctrine. So in a way, you're not being respectful to them when you imply they can change. They can't change. The only thing that can change where there's value in talking about change is the white attitude toward Jews. And where does the white attitude toward Jews come from? Well, mainly, historically, it's come from our religion since we adopted it, i.e., heads were cut off and kings adopted it, and it was forced on the rest, Christianity. And Christianity insists by its doctrine that the only thing you can do with a Jew is convert it. That's all it needs. Just like an Oompa Loompa from a jungle in Africa, it needs to hear the truth about Jesus, about the one true way. It needs to be brought onto that path. That's the solution. Has that solution worked? It might work with 1 in a million individuals to draw them out of the way of behaving Jewish, but those are simply genetic outliers, is another better, more simpler way to explain that. So no, the Christian way does not work. The only thing that works with Jews is exterminating them. Because if you suppress them, it merely means that you temporarily have power over them. They are still going to persist in trying to dominate your race and wipe its genes, its genetic expression, off the face of the earth. So it's an all-or-nothing, zero-sum fight. But whites are refusing, out of weakness and what they call morality, to acknowledge the true war that's going on. They are courting their own genocide through their inability or their cowardice to look reality in the face and to acknowledge that their own religious doctrine is a grave racial weakener. And in fact, the Jews could set up hardly anything. They couldn't create something more useful to them than Christianity. This is what I argue, and it goes far beyond, of course, anything that Henry Ford is saying. But again, I have the benefit of 100 more years of seeing what Jews would do. But he says, if they had any, they were not attacking Jews in this series of articles. They simply, if they simply were reporting the facts, and if they had a hidden hope, it was that Jews would recognize and adjust their behavior. But that's to take a childishly superficial view of what Jews are and what they can do. They are what they are. Their culture and their genes are one at this point. The proof that these articles have contained facts and only facts is found in the failure of the Jewish spokesman to show any one of them to be false. The record stands that way. Not one disproof. The reason for the record is this. When only facts are sought and are subjected to tests, only facts are found. If, however, one embarks on a campaign whose purpose is to besmirch an opponent or create a prejudice, one's partisan zeal may induce him to accept as facts what is merely probability. These articles, however, do not constitute a campaign. They are lighting of lamps here and there about the country, in this industry and that, in corners heretofore kept dark by those who should serve more faithfully on the watchtower of the press. What the Dearborn Independent has said could have had no weight at all had not the people been able to force to see the same facts all about them. It is not information but illumination that has given these articles the importance they have found among hundreds of thousands of readers. The Jewish response to these articles has in one way been gratifying and in another way quite disappointing. The Jewish response has been gratifying in that it has furnished substantial proof of all the statements made in the Dearborn Independent. That's the paper where these articles appeared, of course. Dearborn, Michigan, which is today, ironically enough, completely Muslim, thanks to the Jews operating American immigration policy. This journal has no doubt of the truth of its statements and is possessed of a very substantial reserve of evidence. But nonetheless, the corroborative evidence produced by the Jewish leaders themselves in endeavoring to meet the issue is appreciated. There is no reason to believe that this was an intentional contribution on the part of Jewish leaders. It was simply impossible for them to move without revealing further evidence. It is quite well known what is the position of Jewish leaders today. It is one of fear. For once they themselves are possessed with the fear of the unknown. Knowing how much of truth exists behind the statements made in this series, they are in fear of what may yet come forth. They do not even make any more pretense of considering it a joke. In their own conclaves, they do not rave and roar like the rabbinical editors. They behave themselves like sober, frightened men who sometimes have a desire to own up to some of the things that have been charged, but who are halted by a doubt as to how far the owning up process would lead them if once begun. They are in fear of the truth, but mostly of the whole truth. Needless to say, a responsibility rests also on those who hold the whole truth. The purpose determines everything. If the purpose is to breed hatred of the Jews, that involves one course of action. If the purpose is to excite the public mind with startling facts, that involves another course of action. There is a certain danger in certain kinds of information. If the purpose is to lay a basis for intelligent, straightforward understanding and possible solution of the question, then such information as defines the question and presents all essential material is all that is necessary. It is within these limits that this series has endeavored to keep. If there are facts which are unfavorable to the Jews, that is a matter for the Jews. If the Jews do despite to a certain class of facts, it may be necessary to produce still another class of facts. That is, if they claim that you're lying, it may be necessary to pull out even more. If the leaders of the Jews had been fair, just argumentatively, oppositionally fair, they would not now be in fear of what yet may be produced. So he's saying, they know we've said some stuff, and they know it's true, and they also know we could say a lot more. And if need be, we will, is kind of what he's saying. Jews, for illustration, have proved the statement that they are the best organized people in the United States. they have proved that they are more closely grouped together in their own national interest than are the citizens of the U.S., whose whole nationality is defined by their citizenship. Now here's the key. The government of the United States itself is not so well organized as American Jewry. And that fact is not due to anything America. It's not special to America. It is the same in every country. So, what's the secret of Jew success? They're better organized than any other nation on earth. They're better organized than any other government on earth. And that's what allows them, as a comparatively small minority, to dominate everyone else. So if you hear whites talking down organization, you're hearing foolishness. Of course, individuals can go off and commit acts of terror, or lone wolves, as we traditionally call them. But that on its own, save that's part of some master plan, isn't going to do much. You need to have legal above ground organization in order to get people focused on the necessary goals and have a reasonable strategy for achieving them. Accountability, responsibility, and all the rest of the things that organizations provide. It is not for nothing that they control the avenues of communication in this country. It is not for nothing that the wireless of the world is under ironclad Jewish control. Jews control the media, he's saying. Jews control the radio. They are not loosely organized in social lodges for occasional fellowship. They are organized as states of the Jewish people, with officials who do nothing whatever but attend to the advancement of Jewish power in this and other countries. They have proved by the mass play of their synagogues, their newspapers, their alleged social organizations, their conservative clubs, and their Bolshevik socialist groups, all of them working together under orders, that they are a separate people within the American people. A people that do not agree with the genius of the American people, and a people that constantly make distinction between Jewish and American rights. In every state, in every city, there is a Jewish organization with a definite policy, and the first policy is to suffocate, destroy, put the fear of the Jew upon any man, newspaper, or institution that gives the least indication of independent thought on the Jewish question. These organizations have special committees to do certain work. One of these works is to start, quote, a whispering drive against the person or institution aimed at. This whispering drive is a most hideous Oriental device. It can be sustained only by groups of minds which bear a certain racial twist. Without giving a full description of the devices used, it can be seen that the fact of their being centrally controlled and working simultaneously in all parts of the country creates a considerable force. No other institution now operating in the United States can accomplish that so quickly and unitedly. Jewish solidarity would be above criticism were it used to benefit the whole communal life, but it is not. It is not only Jewish, but its operations show it to be largely anti-American. This does not mean anti-American in the sense of being pro-German or pro-Mexican, but in this sense, that it opposes many of the things that have been conceded to constitute the American tradition. So Jews are against American traditions and using their organization to attack them. The Jew assumes that the United States is still an unformed entity which is fair prey to any who can seize it and mold it. That is his attitude today. He refuses to assume that America is here. He adopts the belief that part of his duty is to bring America into being on Jewish lines, of course. Now, in a sense, the United States is private property. It is the property of those who share the ideals of the founders of the government. And those ideals were ideals held by a white race of Europeans. They were fundamentally Christian ideals. And with most of these, the Jews not only disagree, but hold them in contempt. Indeed, a Jewish leader recently said in New York that the United States was not a Christian land, and the context of his statement showed that he clearly intended that it never should be. He was condemning the Christian Sunday, though he is an officer of a society whose purpose is the establishment of the Mosaic Sabbath. The Jews have also proved the charge that they exercise disproportionate influence in governmental affairs. This charge has only been stated in this series. The massive proof has not yet been brought to bear, but it exists fixed beyond all change that Jews are disproportionately influential in government. However, another important bit of evidence has been transpiring before the country's eyes. When the immigration bill was first put up to Congress, again, this was the bill that would ultimately be passed 4 years later in 1924, but Jews, it had been talked about for years, and the Jews were agitating in favor of essentially filling Syria with Germany, so to speak, mutatis mutandis, necessary changes being made, since we're talking in an American context. They wanted to make immigration. All Jews get in from wherever, and everyone else who's let in is mostly a third world, in order to change the racial basis of the country. Jews always use immigration in white lands as a racial attack upon the natives, and they use their courts and media to deny that whites even are the natives. When the immigration bill was first put up to Congress, the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of restricting entry into the country. Congress voted upon the facts and its patriotic convictions. Taking the question just as it was, no other verdict could have been given. Hardly had the vote been taken, however, than the wires were hot and the trains crowded in Jewish protests, and Jewish agents began flocking to Washington. The magic name Jew was uttered. Legislators fled to cover. Learned speeches were made. Compromises were suggested. Modifications of the original law were framed. Under the magic of the Jew, the whole proposal simply melted like an icicle before a fire. The only protest made against the congressional vote was made by Jews. Their wonderful teamwork in all parts of the country gave their protest the air of national importance. But there was one point the Jews were not able this year to deny, and that is that the majority of the immigrants are Jews. That fact, fortunately, was established beforehand. The hand, and remember, we've heard in earlier chapters how they're not allowing the census that we're constitutionally bound to take every 10 years. The Jews demanded that they not be counted in that, as Jews, in order to hide their true numbers. And they were able to manipulate Congress into going along. The hand of the Congress of the United States was stayed by the Jews in a matter of serious importance to national protection just as a few years ago, the hand of Congress of the U.S. was forced to break the treaty with Russia when President Taft held it would be wrong to break it. And we heard about this about three chapters ago, I think it was. This proof of political power, based on nothing but sheer force and sheer determination to have what they want regardless of what the United States wants, has appeared broadcast as a matter of public knowledge. And let the reader mark this. It will be found that this present immigration move is as much a part of the Jewish World Program, the protocols of learned elders, as was the breaking of the treaty with Russia. Readers of the article of January 15 will recall how, at the behest of the Jews, the United States trade with Russia was thrown into the hands of German Jews in Frankfurt, who were using it to further their plans for the destruction of the Russian Empire, which later came to pass. The Jews, quote, used, unquote, the United States to put across an essential part of that plan. Well, what are they using the United States for now? We may well believe that the Jews are not without several reasons for what they are doing. The Jew excels as a chess player because he plays a game wherever he may be. The immigration matter amounts to this, quote, or colon, Jews are streaming out of Poland as speedily as they can. It is not, quote, pogroms, unquote, that are driving them out. Pogroms have been proved to be an immigration propaganda for consumption outside Poland. The Jews are leaving Poland because they know something is going to happen. And if they are leaving Poland, it is a sign it is going to happen in Poland. And if the Jews have advance news of it, it is a sign that what will occur will be inflicted by Jews. Plainly, it is this. Jewish Bolshevism in Russia has made a secret decree against Poland. The Jews are getting out of the way. American Jewish agents are constantly passing into Poland. Rich American Jews are sending agents to bring back groups of, quote, relatives, unquote. There is an exodus from Poland, and there is a reason for it which spells trouble for Poland. The United States is being used as the chief means by which the Jews are to clear out. France protests against them and will not have them. England most decidedly refuses to have them. The Jews of the United States are powerful enough to compel this country to take them. We are utilized to effect the entrance of Bolshevism into Russia. It went out from our east side thither, from New York to Russia. We are now being utilized to assist at the destruction of Poland. It is possible, however, that by the time the Jewish program reaches that point, something may have intervened. The Jews of the United States have also given a splendid illustration of what the Dearborn Independent said of their control of American newspapers. Of course, the local newspaper editor is not dominated by any Jewish authority seated at Washington, New York, or Chicago. Of course not. But he is very amenable to the 20 richest Jews in his community who advertise in his paper, and it is they who take orders from Washington, New York, and Chicago. So the editor gets his orders from Jewish headquarters just the same, though he may not realize it. This, however, is one instance where publicity does not count because it represents a business favor oftener than it does an editorial conviction. The knowledge of the Jewish question, which newspaper men possess, is quite complete, and a confidential council of the best-informed editors of the United States would include all that the government or the people would need to know for a complete handling of the Jewish question, so people in media know what's going on with Jews. The publicity demanded and received by the organized Jews has proved a roarback. It has served the cause of truth more than the cause they desired, which was a suppression. And there's a word you may not be familiar with, which is roarback, R-O-O-R-B-A-C-H. It's a false or and more or less damaging report circulated for political effect, usually about a candidate seeking an office. And that comes, dictionary.com tells me, 1844, its origins, Americanism, after a fictitious Baron von Rohrbach, R-O-O-R-B-A-C-K, in whose travelogue occurred an account of an incident damaging to the character of James K. Polk. So it's a false report circulated for political benefit, making something up about somebody. Now, the publicity demanded and received by the organized Jews has proved a roarback. It has served the cause of truth more than the cause they desired, which was suppression. Gratifying as these proofs are to the producers of the facts, there is a very decided element of disappointment in the Jewish answers. Either Jewry is fainting or it is defenseless. Certainly the present status of the matter of the defense must be humiliating to those who have any conception of the importance of the matter. The answers signed by the Jews themselves, a list of signatures which showed, as in panorama, the close-locked corporational solidarity of the Jewish race in this country. That is, when they use corporation in that sense, they mean a body. It shows the Jews are a tightly woven body. Was devoid of a single fact which threw light. In this, the Jewish answer was almost a confession of no defense. Like nolo contendere, or whatever it is. They can't contend against the facts. They haven't brought out any facts to gainsay what's been asserted in the series of articles produced by the Dearborn Independent. They are essentially conceding that its claims are factually correct. Because as we said, since they control the wireless, they control the national media, if there were false facts, they could circulate that fact, they could refute the false facts, and show the editors of the Dearborn Independent to be liars, but they can't do that. So they have to take the route of suppressing and making counterclaims. But aside from its ineptitude was the utter lack of frankness. It refuses to face the question. It will not meet a single statement, either in the substance of the protocols or in the substance of the series. It veers off whenever it approaches a concrete theme and loses itself in a vapor of denials. If a statement is wrong, it is provably wrong, especially a statement which deals with matters now actual in daily life. The official Jewish answer, signed by a few, not all, of the Jewish leaders, is at least decent in its language, and that is more than can be said for most of the other Jewish answers, but it is indecency, or it is indecent in its attempt to create the impression that anti-Semitism is abroad in the country. So it's never about the facts you cite. It's always about your foul character. That's how the Jew plays it. And he's able to carry it off, not because it's logically valid or factually sound, but because he controls the media, and that means he controls the means of amplification and suppression. Mark this, says Ford. All the anti-Semitism that exists in the United States today is the deliberate creation of the Jewish leaders and is a recent creation. The Jewish leaders want anti-Semitism here. Unable to create it among non-Jews, they are seeking the effects of it among the Jews by telling them that it exists. The Jewish leaders of the United States have done everything possible to keep the Dearborn Independent away from the Jews, to prevent their reading it and learning the fact that no attack is being made on the Jews as Jews. That's in capital letters, so important did Henry Ford think it. Saying, look, we're just printing the facts. We are not attacking Jews as Jews, and the Jewish leaders don't want their people to know it. So again, I don't know if this is the creation of the meme that the Jews are the innocent victims of their rabbis, which is a claim that we often see. We can't scare them. We have to win them away from their rabbis. I don't agree with that point of view at all. I think most Jews are quite aware of what's going on. Not all of them, of course. There are little Jews who don't pay much attention or just born into it and don't really think about it much. But by and large, they're pretty darn racially conscious. And all that entails. From the first, after wrestling for weeks to discover a way of meeting these articles without having to confess too much, these leaders threw up their hands and took refuge in the lie of anti-Semitism. What they ought to fear now is not the force of an anti-Semitic feeling among the non-Jews, but the force of righteous indignation among American Jews when they discover the deceit and incompetence of their leaders. Is he spitting in the wind again? I'd say he is. Anti-Semitism, in quotes, has always been the last resort of scoundrelly Jewish leaders when cornered by the truth. The last resort. It's the first resort, at least now. And they have been known deliberately to incite it among the Gentile rabble in order to, through it, to maintain their hold upon their own people. Yeah, that's a meme that you'll see a lot from Jewish critics. But as I say, I don't think it's the right way to go. I don't really believe it. Recently, there was printed in the newspapers, quote, a protest against anti-Semitism, unquote, signed by various non-Jews. The protest was printed twice, in fact, because it did not go big the first time. Go big, in quotes. The newspapers were evidently growing a little weary of printing daily communiques from Jewish great headquarters, JGH capitalized. So to give it more vim for a thorough circulation, the signature of Woodrow Wilson was obtained. So if you start criticizing Jews using the facts, they run to the president and they run to Hollywood actors and they run to other goyim to get them to sign statements against anti-Semitism. We've all seen that game play out. And of course, that put it on the telegraph wires again, so they did it twice. The second time they got the president involved. It was quite proper for President Wilson to sign a protest against anti-Semitism. It was quite proper for all the other signers to do so, provided that was what they meant to do. If the protest had been sent to the Dearborn Independent, its responsible officials would have signed also. The Dearborn Independent is against anti-Semitism, and protests against leading Jews using its name to foment that spirit. The protest, however innocent the signers may have been of this fact, was against any public discussion of the Jewish question, and especially against this one. The dispatches are careful to state that the Jews had nothing to do with that protest. A supposedly non-Jewish organization has been in the service of a coterie of New York Jews for a long time. So this is a front group of goyim, a goy front, used to advance a Jewish agenda by making it appear to be a neutral thing. The assertion that the, quote, protest, unquote, was written, quote, by a single citizen, a non-Jew, acting upon his own initiative and responsibility and without consultation with anybody, end quote, is mildly amusing. There was just enough consultation, in quotes, to make the whole, quote, non-Jewish protest, unquote, nothing more nor less than a previously approved document. As is typical, the Jew writes it all up for the goy and then pretends that the goy did it himself. And the citizen who did the job has known for a long time where it pays to please. As to Mr. John Spargo, S-P-A-R-G-O, whose name is beginning to appear prominently as a Gentile defender of the Jews. This much is known. He did not undertake the Jewish defense without several secret consultations with a group of New York Jews, who had to overcome several of Spargo's scruples before they could make much headway with him. Spargo's attitude was something like this. "Gentlemen, they've got it on you. It's not a matter that can be whitewashed." Spargo told a lot of truth in that, and that was a direct quote. "They've got it, gentlemen, they've got it on you. It is not a matter that can be whitewashed," unquote. Spargo told a lot of truth in that New York room. The Jewish conferees knew it was truth. If Spargo should speak 1/20th as much truth on the platform, his lecture engagements would dwindle in number. All of the literature of the Anti-Defamation Society, all of the speech of the retained defenders, is very welcome. Open the question up. If the Jews engage enough Gentile defenders, the time will come when Gentile logical faculties will bring about a real discussion of the question. The Jewish spokesmen must, on pain of losing their position, limit themselves to denials, abuse, and threats. But the Gentile defenders are constitutionally unable to dwell in that state of mind for long. They will probe through to the truth, in which event real discussion may be expected. Now see, here Ford is verging into what I said earlier. He's verging into the recognition, almost against himself, that basically Jews are not racially honest. That what he's dealing with is a racial problem. It's not something that can be cleared up, contrary to what he is saying and asserting elsewhere. He's basically saying that Goyim are racially honest. Therefore, even if they are bought off at the start and put out front by Jews to discuss this, their native genetic honesty will eventually lead them to penetrate to the truth, which, is, of course, is on the side of the Jew critics. He's saying Jews on their own won't do that. So he's basically almost getting to the point where he understands this is an intractable genetic racial difference. But if he were to bring that out openly, he would be then forced to consider, although he'd probably claim at least to be horrified, my contention that ultimately all you can do is kill them off, because they're not going to change. They are what they are. And what we see in nature is that subspecies do battle for turf until one destroys the other. That's what's going on. Accept it. But just to repeat that last bit, but the Gentile defenders, the Jewish spokesmen must, on pain of losing their position, limit themselves to denials, abuse, and threats. That is, they can't ever concede that any part of what he's saying in the Dearborn series is correct, or they'll get fired. But the Gentile defenders are constitutionally unable to dwell in that state of mind for long. They will probe through to the truth, in which event real discussion may be expected. There is not a single Jewish publication, however vituperative and truthless, that we would forbid the males or exclude from a public library. There is not a single Jewish spokesman whom we would heckle or hinder on the public platform. There is not a single Jewish enterprise that we would recommend for boycott. We believe in free speech and unfettered conviction. By means of these, the people may yet hope to clean up the United States. The Jews do not believe in a free speech. They do not believe in a free press. In every state in the Union, the B'nai B'rith is introducing the local legislatures a bill that will prevent any publication from saying anything derogatory of the Jews. That is the Jews' answer to the facts produced in this publication, i.e. their hate crimes law. Any criticism of Jews is hate and must be forbidden. No other race should be allowed to talk about Jews, but Jews are allowed to see other races as animals and to bring about their genocide. That's how it is, folks. In scores and hundreds of libraries, the Jews are using the members of their race who happen to be on library boards, or are using committees of their race to influence library boards to clear the libraries of all books, pamphlets, and papers that deal with the Jewish question in a manner to leave any doubt that Jews are paragons of virtue and the chosen people. This is occurring in the United States. It is occurring in some of those Eastern American states that stood most valiantly for the cause of free speech and a free press in other days. Let it go on. Multiply the instances. Add madness to madness. Each act of this nature simply gives a local proof, visible and intelligible to each community where it transpires, that what is written about the Jews is true. The present status of the Jewish question in the United States is this. : A beginning has been made on the too long accumulating facts. Jewish recognition of the truth has been expressed in soberness among the leaders, in private, obviously. Jewish action in response has been, for themselves, denial, for others, suppression. Suppression in capital letters. The result to date is, abject failure to meet the case. 29 January 1921. So, he's saying, we put out the case, they've denied it and suppressed it, tried to suppress things, tried to get hate crimes laws passed to make it illegal to criticize Jews. So they're implicitly conceding that what we say about them is true. And how much worse is it 100 years later? Well, in most lands, I'm taping this in the United States where I'm protected by the First Amendment, but in most lands, what I've taped, in most lands in Europe, it would be grounds for a criminal action. I would be thrown in jail for what I've just told you. And that's what the Jews seek to do everywhere as they attempt to bring about the genocide of the white race. Jews must be exterminated if you desire your kind, white man, to continue to exist on the face of the earth. That will close out Volume 2, Chapter 42. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.